On a regional level, Britain has one of the widest geographical disparities when it comes to productivity, wealth, income per head compared to other large, advanced countries. Amazingly, average incomes in Nottingham are 4.5 times less than someone who lives in London's Kensington and Chelsea. Another shocking figure is predicted that the wealth gap between someone living in the north and someone living in the south will reach almost £250,000 by 2030. It's a staggering disparity, and it's getting worse. It's not only offensive in terms of fairness and life chances, it should not matter as much as it does where you were born to fulfill your potential and live life to the fullest. It's also a ball and chain around the whole economy. If parts of the country like the Midlands, the north of England, the southwest, Scotland or Wales could even partially close the gap with London and the southeast, our economic prospects would be transformed. How have we let it get this bad? What can be done to solve it? And are there lessons from an extraordinary economic performance of the United States under President Joe Biden, even though he lost the 2024 presidential election? Three leading social scientists have come together to offer answers in two co-authored reports. Ed Balls may have been a Labour cabinet minister. He was education secretary under Gordon Brown and shadow chancellor under Ed Miliband, and now a successful podcast host and broadcaster, but he's also a formidable economist. Alongside Ed, we have Dr. Anna Stansbury, an assistant professor of work and organization studies at MIT, who specializes in unmasking the dynamics of labor markets and the role of trade unions. And Dan Turner, who's the chief research officer in the office of Gordon and Sarah Brown, leading research into national and regional inequalities, growth, and the rise of populism. They challenge some long-standing assumptions and foreground explanations that we know need more foregrounding, but have been hitherto not given enough emphasis. And all against the background of the government's recently published industrial strategy. Lots to discuss. So fantastic to have all three of you on the line. Let's just kick off. I mean, I wound up there by saying, and this is a striking, what struck me reading your reports was actually kind of, you really do, you know, stress some things and play down others. And rather than me put those words into your mouth, do you want to speak to that? Ed, it'd be good to hear from you.
Well, the idea of regional gaps and a north-south divide has been, you know, a reality in kind of British economic policy discussion for 100 years and more. And when I was a young graduate student out at Harvard in the late 1980s, I wrote a paper with Larry Summers and Larry Katz around the North-South divide. We were looking at divides in unemployment and employment and how they had widened in the 1980s. I returned to Harvard back in 2015, back then linked up with Anna, who was at the time pre-PhD working with Larry Summers. And we thought that we would look again at this question of regional inequality in Britain. Dan was a Kennedy School student at the time when he was at the outset of our work, gone on to work for the South Yorkshire mayor, as well as pursuing his academic studies. I think the striking thing to us when we went back and looked was that, one, it wasn't really a story about employment and unemployment. And that 1980s characterization has changed. It's now about productivity and an output. Actually, there's much more alignment in employment and unemployment rates. But the second striking thing was that while in other European countries, you'd seen a narrowing of regional differentials in the last 20 years. In Britain, they'd continued to widen. I mean, amazingly, we now have a greater gap between London and the southeast and the rest of the UK regions than you have between East and West Germany, or between North and South Italy, which is something you have to kind of really think about to take in. But then I think when we dug deeper into that, we were expecting to find this to be a story of different industrial patterns. But Anna was the person who pointed out to us that isn't really the case.
Yes. So because of the deindustrialization in the North and the Midlands in particular in the 80s, the industrial structure in terms of the broad sectors of the economy that employ different shares of people is actually now relatively similar between the southeast in London versus the rest of the country. And the gap is really about the gap in living standards, the gap in output is really about different productivity within sectors. And what we mean by productivity, to be very clear, is not some innate quality of the people or places. It's simply the sales value of the output produced divided by the number of people producing that output. So something is going wrong in the economic structure in these in the regions that are outside London and the southeast that means that the productivity of that output is lower than it could be. And one thing I'll emphasize, it's not possible in any country to equalize outputs and incomes across all places. For example, we know across countries that cities, because of the modern structure of the knowledge economy, are just much richer and more productive. But the thing that stands out from the UK perspective is that our non-London cities are particularly low productivity and low income compared to other similar sized cities, either in Europe or the US.
Now, Anna,
so it's really our cities that are underperforming.
Before we go into why and solutions, I mean, just give us a sense of, you know, how dramatic this is.
Specifically Manchester and Birmingham, which are two very large cities. If you compare them to similarly sized cities of a couple million people in, say, France or Germany, you're seeing incomes per capita or productivity levels that are maybe 50% higher and sometimes twice as high in some of these similar sized cities in these other countries.
That's stunning. It makes the lottery of where you're born incredibly important and unfair, but also kind of is a ball and chain on the whole economy. So, I mean, what's the root cause? Dan, what's your view?
One of the paradoxes that we were grappling with when we very first studied this project was if you just have your Economics 101 class, you'd be asking, well, why do these divides persist over time? Why is it that markets, migration, and so on don't just cancel it out? And you've mentioned a few times this idea of a lottery of birth. But obviously we know lots of people in the UK move across the country regularly, several times over their lifetime. So there's something that's happening that is stopping those mechanisms of economic adjustment and decentralized decision making from smoothing out regional inequalities.
Let's hear from you, Anna.
So the approach we take is we break down the UK into its constituent national and regional economies. And then we basically look at what you might call the different inputs to growth. What are the different factors that enable an economy to produce more, to grow faster? And those, the four that we look at are education, infrastructure, research and development, and access to finance. Each of these four categories across each of those regional economies. And I think one of the quite surprising findings that we identified is that we often talk about skills gaps. And it's true that in London and the Southeast, there are people, a larger share of people have a university degree, a larger share of people have got post-A-level qualifications. But in our analysis, it doesn't look like skills gaps overall are the factor that is holding back the economic development, the growth, the productivity of the regions outside London and the Southeast.
I found that surprising, but that was good. That was, yeah. So we're now left with the other three.
Yes. So the one caveat to that is STEM skills in particular still seem like they're important and in high demand across the country, not only in the non-London regions, also in London. So we argue that there should be a focus still on STEM skills, but otherwise it's the other factors that seem to be more important, particularly infrastructure and R&D. So on infrastructure, one of the really surprising things is that actually the effective size of the UK's cities is much smaller than you would think given their population. And by effective size, I mean how many people can reach the city centre at rush hour within a certain time, like within half an hour. And this is because the UK's cities have reached an unhappy medium between the two possible ways that you can make cities effective transport-wise. In Europe, cities tend to be connected very well by public transport and dense housing. In America, cities tend to be wide and sprawling, but connected with lots of roads. And so UK cities are unusually congested in their roads, but also have unusually poor public transport. And therefore, the effective size is small. And so this can help explain why some of our ostensibly large cities aren't actually performing as well as you'd expect, because they aren't as large in practice. And so they don't get to benefit from the agglomeration and dynamism of having a lot of people and a lot of businesses in the same place.
I mean, the hours it can take to get into the centre of Birmingham or Manchester, Leeds, is astonishing, isn't it? I mean, it's really, you know, effectively, rather than millions of people being able to get there within half an hour, you're talking about hundreds of thousands.
our paper was not a detailed assessment of the case for HS2. And while we were writing our papers, the Conservative governments and then the Labour government decided not to carry on with HS2. But there was no doubt our analysis says if you really want to have a big impact upon productivity and growth in our regional economies outside London, you do what London's done, which is you invest heavily in local transport in order to make your cities bigger and more integrated and more productive. And so investing in connecting Leeds and Manchester, or Birmingham and Manchester, or Manchester and Liverpool, but also within those cities, allowing people to get in from neighbouring towns, from the suburbs, to work across the city region, that is the transport investment priority. And it's really not been what we've invested in for decades. I mean, you know, as we show very clearly in our paper, our transport investment numbers have been poor persistently for a very long period of time, especially when you're talking about local transport outside London and the South East. So, you know, if you want to know what's going on, it's good to have more people going to university in Manchester and Leeds, or from Manchester and Leeds, but that is not the constraint. The constraint, or number one big constraint on growth, is make these cities more integrated through investment in local transport.
And you mean buses, you mean underground, you mean railway, overground railway, I mean, you mean the whole damn thing. Dan?
Something we've been glossing over so far, Will, is that there's no one single story, and it will vary place by place. So in our analysis, we show that Cambridge, for instance, has really acute problems around trains, whereas in lots of northern metro areas, the problems start with the bus network. You know, it might be better to have a mass transit system like trams or an underground system ultimately, but we really don't even get the basics right in things like bus networks at the moment. So there's not going to be a single answer for every single sub-region of the UK. But as a general thrust, this issue of a lack of effective transport seems to be a real constraint.
And that's transport. I mean, and access to finance. Now, here, I was surprised about that because in a work I've done, which is kind of emphasizes the role these days of venture capital in building businesses, particularly in technology, that actually there's a chronic shortage of venture capital kind of outside London, Oxford, Cambridge. You know, the amount of, I mean, it's just tiny. And I was surprised, actually, that you felt that access to finance was not an issue, or less an issue than...
I mean, there, Will, I mean, this is the binding constraints framework which we use. We don't disagree with you that when you look at the absolute numbers on venture capital, the numbers are low. But the question is that the constraint? Are there firms who would be growing but for the availability of finance? Or is the lower availability of finance a product of there not being demand from firms asking for that finance in order to grow? And that is something which we dug in hard in the paper. I think Anna's best place to speak about that.
We found no evidence that there is different attitudes to bank financing for firms outside London and the South East, that firms feel more constrained outside London and the South East, which just kept pulling up. You know, every indicator we looked up, it kept pulling up a zero. There's no evidence. The one indicator that fits with your point, Will, about venture capital, the one indicator where some regions do look like this might be a constraint is specifically on access to early stage equity financing for high growth potential SMEs in certain regions. And particularly those regions look like the Midlands and Yorkshire from our analysis, and potentially the Northwest. And there the idea is that there do seem to be lower probabilities that if you took an equivalent firm in, say, the Midlands versus that same firm in London, it might have a lower probability of getting equity financing in that early stage. And that specific portion could be limiting growth.
On the other hand, Will, talking about investment, the place where we see a very striking pattern is in research and development. And where, in fact, the private sector is more likely to invest in R&D, in innovation, outside London and the South East than the public sector, even though overall our pattern of innovation R&D spend in aggregate across the country is very London and the Southeast biased. So, you know, if the question was, have we over the last 50 years been trying to encourage those parts of the country with lower productivity to get ahead and be the places companies want to set up and grow through the public sector investment in innovation, research and development, the answer is we've been doing the opposite of that. The private sector is more likely to be investing outside London and the South East than the public sector.
Yeah, the work I've done shows that some of the universities that you wouldn't expect to kind of produce the biggest bang for buck in terms of patents for £100 million worth of money dispersed through UKRI one way or another. Yeah, the universities of Leicester, the universities of Southampton, Northern Gritstone, this is kind of local authority-backed venture capital company, has done fantastically well in kind of Leeds and really a big, big role in backing one of our fastest-growing semiconductor companies, Pragmatic Semiconductor, which is partly run out of Manchester, research in Cambridge, but manufacture in Durham. I mean, the neglect of what could be possible in these cities outside London is kind of, it's painful, isn't it?
Yes, but I think we would look at the evidence and say that is not because of a lack of skilled workforces who want to do those jobs. It's because not enough kind of catalytic investment has come in, you know, from the public sector to encourage the private sector to follow. We were very conscious when we did this kind of analytic work. And I think it was, it's been heavily studied and we've had a lot of conversations with the Treasury and Department of Business and Trade, with MHCLG, the local government department, because I think, like you, they had thought the story was a skills story and it was very striking to them when we argued, actually, although there is a STEM skill path to this, the real issue is about transport and innovation. And that's where you've really got to focus. But the one thing which is much harder to do in that kind of empirical-based economics is to get into the institutional questions. And it's very hard to do that in a comparative way because it's so hard to compare the institutions of different countries, let alone hard to find ways with data to compare over time. So we supplemented the analytic work with numbers, with more qualitative work. We did 100-hour-long interviews with policymakers who've been involved in the making of local, regional, national economic policy in the last 40 years, from, you know, prime ministers, John Major, Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, chancellors, business secretaries, local government leaders, heads of regional development agencies, people who've been observing this academically or in the sort of business world. And I think one of the very striking things in those interviews, all of which are kind of on the record and online, is that all of the politicians, in retrospect, regret the approach they took for most of the time they were in government, which was to hurry to pull levers from the centre and to think that doing the devolving would take too long. And it's only when they get a certain way down the track, whether this is John Major with Michael Heseltine or George Osborne or, you know, I think Tony Blair as well, who was a great centralist. And they realise that it's very hard to really drive local sub-regional economic development from the centre. And so I think one of the questions which we also raise is whether you can embed a culture of partnership between the centre and local sub-regional economic leaders, which is actually strong and real and empowering rather than centralising and built to last. Because what always seems to happen is people realise at the end of their time in power, it would have been a good idea. They do it late. The next guys come in and rip it all up, whether that's the regional development agencies or whatever, and then start all over again. So I think one of the things we also argue for is you need to have a new settlement in the way in which we govern, and that actually the combination of combined authorities and elected mayors, which started actually with Blair and Brown, and then was expanded by Cameron and Osborne, and after a little bit of Boris Johnson's centralisation, was then sort of reactivated by Rishi Sunak and Jeremy Hunt, and now we hope being taken forward by Angela Rayner, Keir Starmer, Rachel Reeves, that there is an opportunity to kind of embed a consensus around kind of around local and sub-regional leadership. And we think that is very important alongside what you do, you know, in terms of numbers and investment. So the test for the industrial policy white paper and more widely for the Treasury's budget economic policy is not only are they doing enough on transport, innovation, kind of investing in what we say are the drivers of sub-regional productivity, but are they also trying to take a different approach to the way in which we govern the country? And, you know, I think honestly, Will, on both of those things, on the numbers and on the devolution, I think the jury is still out.
Very out. I mean, there's some warm words, and some of the structures are in place, but the I'm not sure you would see that as the kind of organising intent of the industrial strategy. I mean, although in fairness, this mandating the British Business Bank and UKRI to get kind of to work together. I mean, you can see the germs of something that is kind of, and here we kind of get to the second of your papers, almost Biden-esque, really. It's kind of Joe Biden without the big dollars that he was prepared to spend on reindustrialization and running the economy hot. But it has shadows of that, doesn't it?
So the Prime Minister, in his accompanying foreword and op-eds that he put out alongside the industrial strategy, stressed that the intention wasn't that this was about government getting out of the way and just letting business do what it was going to do. But instead, this was about a new posture from the government to be working as alongside and in collaboration with and as a partner actively to business. And that was the single strongest message we heard in the second paper when we were interviewing insiders within the Biden administration.
Just a brief pause in the conversation to tell you a bit about the Academy of Social Sciences, which is the organisation behind the We Society podcast. I'm Will Hutton, the president of the Academy of Social Sciences. We're a national body for academics, practitioners, and learned societies in the social sciences. We champion the vital role of social science in our society, from education to government and business. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work, support us, or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. Well, I think one of the striking things about the US economy over the last 30 years, and I'm very struck by it, that half the companies quoted on the New York Stock Exchange have been generated kind of in the last kind of 40 years. You know, the top companies in the United States are almost completely different from the ones they were 15, 20 years ago. I mean, there's been a technological transformation of the U.S. economy, and that was happening side by side with this kind of running the economy hot. So you had lots of jobs to go to generated by this kind of vibrant tech sector and a lot of employment generation. And actually, like the Blue Touch paper, and off it went. And actually, it was partly a private sector story and partly a public sector story.
I think that's right, Will. Although I think the danger is that narrows our policy focus, that version of the story. But I don't think what you said is wrong. But it's easy to look at America and say, running the economy hot in the last 5 years was a good thing for macro job creation. Question mark, did they go a bit too far? Was it inflationary? Did that help loosen the election? But we certainly say that hot economies consistent with keeping inflation under control are really helpful for growth and job creation. It's also the case that they have a massive single market, and within which, as you said, they've had a burgeoning dynamic tech sector grow. And what's happened in Britain in the last 10 years is that we have withdrawn from our massive single market by leaving the European Union. And while we may have done a bit better than our European partners in the burgeoning tech sector, I think a better way to say it is that they've done worse than us rather than we've done a huge amount better than them. But what is striking is that America, Britain, France, Germany, all of us had a long sustained period of low productivity and income growth after the financial crisis. You can argue that America was a little bit coming out of that after 2015, but the dramatic change in America happens from kind of 2019, 2020 up to today, the last 5 or 6 years. I mean, fairly coterminous with the Biden period. This is a period in which you have a global pandemic in which Britain and other European countries, through furlough schemes, keep people in jobs. The Americans, because they couldn't do a furlough-style scheme, accepted a massive spike in unemployment. Talking to the Biden people, as we do, because we did interviews alongside our analysis for this Bidenomics paper, they were all really worried that the pandemic was going to entrench high unemployment. What actually happened, Will, was a spike in unemployment and then a huge fall in unemployment, massive job creation, high vacancies, a big re-switching in the labour market, as Dan explains, people moving from job to job in a way which actually increased wages for the bottom decile and the second decile. Low-wage workers were disproportionately benefiting. It was a better period, relatively, for women and for black workers, who tend to be groups who did less well in the United States. You had a period of dynamic churn in the labour market, which we might have all ex-ante thought would be lead to rising inequality, and actually had the opposite effect. It actually was better for workers who normally do less well, and boosted productivity and wage growth. And so that's, I mean, I don't think that says we want another pandemic. But what it says is that when you have a pandemic-style shock and it unleashes a period of dynamism, that can give you progressive productivity gains which benefit lower-paid workers. And part of the challenge we have in Britain and other European countries is we've not had a period like that for the last 20 years. Now, we know from the early 1980s, as we say in our regional policy paper, that if you have a period of high unemployment which doesn't go along with that kind of dynamic job creation, and it happens in a sort of very kind of damagingly sectoral way, it can end up entrenching long-term inequality. So hysteresis matters. The thing which is really interesting about America the last 5 years, you didn't have a negative hysteresis effect.
Hysteresis? You better explain that, Ed. Explain hysteresis.
Hysteresis meaning that when unemployment spikes up, it becomes entrenched and long-term. It sort of becomes part of the underlying fabric of the economy. The Biden people thought in 2021, by not having furlough and allowing unemployment to spike, they might be about to entrench in a hysteresis way long-term unemployment in America. In fact, the opposite was the case. And so what that says to us is, and this wasn't happening in the tech sector or in the manufacturing sector, it was happening broad-based across the economy. This was people moving from less productivity to higher productivity, jobs in restaurants and in service sector and in shops and in retail and across the broader economy. So finding ways in which your economies can be dynamic and churning and job moving and firm starting, it seems, you know, the evidence says from America the last 5 years delivers progressive outcomes which are better for low-paid workers, not the opposite. And I don't know whether that's something we've learned yet in Britain and Europe. And, you know, I think we were quite surprised to find that. And if you look at the interviews talking, you know, it to Larry Summers or to Jason Furman.
These are all figures, leading Democrats, yeah.
They were all, I think, quite struck to find this as well. This wasn't what American left of center economists were expecting.
But Ed, if I can just interrupt you, that's because they were right not to expect it, because America hasn't had this for so long. And since the late 1970s, America has been the extreme outlier for non-equitable, non-inclusive forms of growth and stagnation at that median level. So the fact that there's been this turnaround recently suggests it isn't just a case of macroeconomic management, but given that it slightly predates the Biden administration, it also isn't just, you know, good, well-meaning people being in charge who slightly change their posture. There's something that's happening in the US economy that on the fundamentals has shifted. And it isn't just the, it can't just be the scale of the market, because the scale of the market's always been there. It's something else. And I think the best candidate is there's something about the nature of technological change that has hit the US market and has hit the US market for pushing 10 years now that hasn't yet managed to make it across.
But the point is, Dan, that is not in tech sectors. It's not tech jobs. Yeah. It's tech being used across the economy in a much more broad way. That's the thing which seems to be happening, right?
Yes, exactly, exactly.
And I buy into this. And I mean, I think there's a whole story. And I think, I mean, we mentioned venture capital higher up this interview. I think the role of US venture capital has been phenomenally important. I mean, the bigs, the Mag 7 kind of tech giants are all venture capital backed, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, we're all of us kind of talking in praise of dynamic capitalism. I mean, you're on record, Ed, as saying, you know, the cooperative movement, the Fabians, you're not embarrassed about being a socialist. Here you are admiring capitalism at work.
Look, I learned in the early 1990s from the work of David Card and Alan Kruger, and by the experiments which happened in state by state in the United States, that a dynamic economy, understanding that there was imperfect competition in low-wage labour markets, could introduce a minimum wage and raise it alongside tax credits like earned income tax credits, and in so doing, both deliver dynamic job creation and increase fairness in the labour market. And I don't think there is an inconsistency between believing in the dynamism of markets and in believing in the right role for government in intervening in order to make sure you get fair outcomes. But the striking thing is, I think too often left of centre economists fall into a view which says that in order to be progressive and deliver fairer outcomes, maybe what we ought to do is try and make our markets, our labour markets, less dynamic. Whereas actually what we're saying from the experience of these last years is that, you know, I agree with Dan, it's not inevitable the outcomes will be fair, but it's also not inevitable from the experience of the last 5 years that kind of blunting dynamism and making it harder for people to move jobs is going to enhance outcomes for lower wage workers, because the American experience seems to be the opposite.
You've interviewed 100 people, you say, in your first report. So you've talked to a lot of kind of politicians who've served, regretting what they did in office and would have done something else if they could live their lives again. I mean, Ed, you're in that position yourself. As you've done this work, what are your own reflections?
Well, look, it's the nature of catharsis and wisdom that you look back and are liberated in being able to say what you ought to have done. And in the case of the 100 regional interviews we did, these were people looking back on 20 or 30 years. In the case of the Bidenomics interviews we did, we were talking to people in December and January who had lost the election in November. So these were people who had just lost their jobs in the Biden administration a few weeks on. So it's very raw. And in that sense, I think they're really worth reading. And they are a powerful counterpart to kind of the more traditional social science economic data work we do, because they allow you to kind of get into things in terms of how institutions work or how the public responds, which are harder to see in the economic data, and they push you to think about your economics in a different way. The striking thing to me, Will, when we go back to the UK regional stuff, and I mentioned earlier people saying, if only we had done things differently. The striking thing to me is that the only things which last are the things which become consensual. You know, Bank of England independence was very controversial, and it's lasted. And the national minimum wage was very controversial, and it's lasted. And actually, tax credits and kind of in-work support through universal credit, although there was a period when we thought it was going to go under George Osborne, it's lasted and it's still an important part of our story. But when it comes to regional and sub-regional economic policy and allowing leadership in skills and partnership with business and universities for investment, planning local transport, we've never, ever managed to build a lasting consensus there. One of the things which we, though, say really strongly in our papers is that unless the Treasury and Number 10 at the centre really together believe this is going to work, then it will fail. And if you look at George Osborne, he was trying really hard to devolve skills to Manchester and to Leeds. He was blocked by the education department. David Cameron, I'm afraid, didn't care enough. And the same thing happened with Gordon Brown. We were trying to devolve skills spending to the regions, and Tony Blair didn't care too much about that, and it was blocked by the education departments. Strong central leadership, and this is a sort of an irony, a strong central leadership commitment to giving up power and devolving, which lasts more than one prime minister and one parliament, is something which has eluded us in regional and sub-regional economic policy decision-making for the last 80-100 years. And if we rip it all up again, then I think it's much harder to make progress on the kind of productivity gaps which we highlight in our papers. And so, you know, I'm still hopeful that Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves believe in this agenda. But as you said, I think a while ago, it's more at the moment in hope than in really concrete reality so far.
And Ed, strategically, I mean, given you've co-authored these reports and given your experience of both being in government and the Westminster Whitehall scene, you know, what one or two things would you really want to see to sign off with?
I'm a great believer in winning the intellectual argument, as well as winning the political argument on the ground. And if in the end a reform is introduced which isn't kind of really underpinned by kind of social science and data and a track record, then it's quite easy for things to wither. And I think that our politics is quite sophisticated, and that those intellectual arguments then shape wider political attitudes as well. And that's partly why, you know, you referred to it at this stage of my life. You know, I think what we are trying to do, and the kind of work which I know the Academy of Social Sciences kind of celebrates, very policy relevant, very economics-y, really kind of embedded with the best data analysis, but also doing new and innovative ways of trying to understand. And I think what we do around qualitative conversations with experts helps as well. When I started out in as a young student in the late 1980s, I worked with Larry Summers, who always said to me, if one data source and one equation points in a particular direction, that's one step on the journey. And you could spend, if you like, the next 2 years looking at that equation and trying to refine it, but it's only going to be one step. Whereas if you come at things from 20 different directions and the majority of directions start to point in the same direction, then you start to feel a bit more confident that you are really understanding things. It's more than just one step. And I know that Anna has worked in her career with Larry at Harvard, written papers with him. And the work which we do is very much in that spirit. We think to ourselves, what are the 10 or 15 different ways in which we can try and answer this question, use the best data analysis. Anna, one of the high-flying young economists in America at the moment, but also using kind of new, different ways of doing research, and which Dan and I have been working on as well. And so I think if social science and economics helps us to answer these questions and shows what works and starts to entrench an intellectual view, I personally think it makes it much harder than in a sort of willful way to rip things up. In another part of the forest, there's just been a great Institute for Fiscal Studies report on SureStart, which shows SureStart had twice the benefits of the cost. But SureStart was dumped in 2010 because there was a change of government and the evidence wasn't there yet. And you couldn't yet make that argument. And too many people were saying, I know, but does it really work? And you know, it's always frustrating when the good economics arrives 10 years too late. But it doesn't mean that that you've lost the argument, you just have to remake it again. But I think what we're trying to do in this work, and it's great to have your support, the Academy support on this, is to use the best economics to try and answer big policy questions in a way which entrenches consensus so that it's harder for short-term politics to come along and rip them up just because it's convenient in one particular year or one particular election. And that's what we've been trying to do. And, you know, and hopefully in a small way, we're making a difference.
Ed, Dan, Anna, thank you very much indeed. That's great. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences in association with the Nuffield Foundation and Leverhulme Trust. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. And thank you so much for listening.